Welcome to the podcast Jakty Ukraine Life. Jakty means how are you in Ukrainian. I'm your host, Lucia Chirky. I'm a former correspondent reporting from Ukraine, now a book author and a freelancer. In this podcast, I always talk to a guest live from Ukraine. The goal of this podcast is to give people in Ukraine the opportunity to talk about their experience of Russia's war against its neighboring country. I'm more than delighted to welcome today's guest on the show, Olga Kulshvar.
Hi.
Hi. Olga is documenting war crimes committed by the Russian army in Ukraine with international journalist teams. She's herself a frontline journalist. Olga Kulshvar was a country project officer at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Before Russia's full-scale invasion, she lived in the northeast of the country, in Kharkiv, but now she is with her family in Lviv, a city in the western part of the country. Thank you so much for being with us today. Today's episode focuses on your work, Olga. You work as a journalist during the past 1,000 days already of Russia's full-scale invasion, and your aim to do even more than documenting war crimes committed by the Russian army against Ukrainians. But before we talk about your work and your plans and ideas for the future, I would like to ask you the question I ask everyone invited to this podcast. Jakty Zaraz, how are you right now?
Okay, thank you. It's really very hard questions, and I don't know what to say about. We are still alive. I am still alive. I'm just alive from the massive air attack. We do not have such big shooting in Lviv, but in the other city, we can see a horrible picture of what happened during this couple of days. A lot of civilian killed, injured. Universities and private residential houses destroyed. So it's a very hard question now. We are still alive and we are still able to resist.
Thank you so much for answering even hard question on this podcast. Olga, you have been working with many, many different international journalist teams in Ukraine. Can you tell the audience briefly how you ended up doing this job?
Okay, thank you for this question. My life divided into two parts. First part before and after huge scale, the second after huge scale escalation. Before that, I work at university and do like a staff, like a faculty of the university and run a lot of different projects. I also work with a journalist, an international one, and run a lot of international projects connected with how to highlight a war since 2014, because this war started not in 2022, but 2014. And this is very important to aware how long this is, period lasts for Ukrainian. But of course, the huge scale escalation is more violent and more visible for all the others. So I started to work with the international team in January of 2022, and the first shelling we experienced in the end of the January, then we was in Lugansk and Donetsk region. And after that, I decided, I just recognized that I don't have any choice. I need to be present here because I am not only work like a journalist, I work like a local producer, and this work is very important because you are eyes and everything for the international journalists that do not know nothing about the context, how to get a permission, how to talk with the people, how to find the contact, and so on, so on. And when we start to working in the fields, I understand that this is my duty to share this experience to the other journalists, also international one and Ukrainian one. And we touched a lot of media companies, small media companies that decided to stay in the frontline areas and highlight all this situation, and Ukrainian journalists, and bring them personal protective equipment and give trainings about this. So it's last till now, but now I'm more focused in like safety and security policy and cybersecurity component for the journalist.
Can you briefly describe, you just mentioned that you felt like a duty of doing this job. Can you describe why you felt this duty? Is there that you felt like obliged to do this job?
It's happened maybe mostly because my home is a Kharkiv region. It's not Kharkiv, it's closer to the border with Russia. And at the start of the huge scale invasion, 22 February, I was in Kyiv, and my family, my husband and my daughter was at home in Kharkiv region, and it was a hardest period in my life because the Russian moved very quickly, and all this territory was occupied by them very, very quickly, and they shelling like heavily 24 hours per day, and I think that I never saw my family again. And when I come back and we managed to evacuate from this frontline area, I decided that this situation should see all the world, and they should also not talking about concern, but act. And the facts and the situation that you witnessing by the eyes of the journalist, by the eyes of average people, by their stories, it is very important. It is like urgent, and you need to be in this field, because I have some experience, because I have some expertise, I have connections, and a lot of journalists asked me to help them. It was like I don't have any choice. It was my acting to the victory, to the resistance of country and something like this.
The audience of this podcast, is happily living in totally different circumstances than people in Ukraine. So people listening to this podcast have luckily never seen a war crime, never seen an army committing war crimes against civilians. Can you describe for people who are not familiar with war crimes how exactly journalists are documenting war crimes, and why it is so important that they do this work?
This is a very important issue, and I think that especially international audience need to understand that sometimes a journalist, it is the first and the only person with whom a civilian who, for example, to have been occupied or witnessing something very horrible are able to talk about this. And for them, it's not only about to share the story, but they believe that this story can change something, can influence on people who listen to it, and they not be like, okay, it's a horrible story, but they try to change the situation and influence on this. Because I heard a thousand of story, and first time when you ask questions, you just stop to breathe, because you understand that an answer would be horrible. And people talking about horrible things without any emotion, they just looking through you and talking about horrible crimes. And at first time, you even deny to believe that the other human beings could do this with the humans, with the children, with the women, and it's genocide of the nation. It's not a war with some rules, and when the military combat with the military, it's against the humanity. It's against the main values. And yes, and if you do not like this, it is normal that you this story frightened you very well. But you need to act, not to see the story anymore, not to continue the story, to do something, to ask your politics to influence on this situation, to make the story more public, because it's not only about Ukrainians, it's about the humanity and the safe international safety, and about the how the other country can commit a crime publicly, and nobody cares, and nobody can stop this country.
Why is it so difficult, after having documented war crimes, and after, many proofs were found in Ukraine that Russian soldiers committed war crimes, why is it so difficult to bring those people that have committed these war crimes to justice? What is your experience? Why is it so difficult?
Oh, it is difficult. It depends of what we mean. If we want to see, for example, Putin in a court, it's the one case, and it is really very difficult, and we need to do cooperatively, like internationally, some things, and we're talking a lot about international tribunals and importance on this. And we have like a lot of cases, like Slobodan Milosevic cases, and so on. And we need to move in this area. But if we talk about like average soldiers that committed a crime, we have a lot of evidence, and the only thing is to find these people and to bring them to the court, because a lot of even journalists do very important work to identify the criminals who committed some crimes, because sometimes they use TikToks to just show how they, I don't know how even how to describe this situation. So they do not hide their crimes. They talk publicly about this because for them, they are hero in the friends and community, and even some relatives said, oh, okay, do something to the Ukrainian, do something bad to the Ukrainian. But in general, we need to be united in this area and understand that all these cases, we have more than 1,073 cases. It's a lot. We need to make them working to put this person in court, because this is our responsibility for people who have been killed, who have been tortured, and who never see this in their real life. But this is our duty also and our responsibility for this.
When came the moment for you personally? I remember talking to you when we first met in Vienna a few weeks ago, that you told me that you would like to do more than documenting war crimes, that there should be more done. When was the moment for you personally that you have decided, so there should be done more than just like the documentation of war crimes? When was that? Do you remember that?
You see, it's like a very complicated emotional situation, because when you, for example, come back to the same liberated villages and see the same people who you've talked, for example, 6 months ago or 1 year ago when it was liberated, just was liberated, and they talk with you and talk about the cases of they witnessing about the crimes, how the Russian tortured their neighbors, or how they killed the neighbors, or about the collaborants who collaborate with the Russians, and they have hope, and they talk about this with you like a journalist, not only to highlight the situation, but they believe that something happened, and something the criminals won't be punished. And when you come back for some period to the same village and saw this ice again and saw these people, and they a little bit demotivated and desperate, because nothing happened. They are shelling every day. The flying aviation bomb destroyed their houses. The Russian continue to kill civilians, their neighbors, their friends, and so on, so on. So this is like unfair situation without any solution for them. And you feel guilty because you talk about this publicly. You do what you can. You documentate in all this. You cooperate with profile departments and with organization who collected this evidence. But nothing happened. And this is really very bad situation, and also for the journalists and for the activists who work in this area, and they only collect and heard these horrible stories and didn't see or observe how it could be change the situation. Of course there are some changes. We should be like absolutely clearly that there are some changes, there are some positive changes. We do a lot, we make a capacity. We united a lot of international actors in this field, but there are still not enough. And this is very important to understand, not only for Ukrainian community, but also for international community. They should be more maybe proactive even in this field, and to support not only by words, but by the real mechanism, how make this possible more quickly, because a lot of people want to be alive still when these criminals go to the court. and see the result of their testimony on the box.
Do you yourself, you want to see that?
Yeah, yeah. It's my dream when I first saw a Russian soldier that laughing when he telling a story about how he raped Ukrainian women and girls. My wish it was so clear. I want to see him in court. I want to understand that all these people have been punished, not just stay ahead and laughing and say, okay, you can do nothing, but punished by the system of punishment that accepted in democratic society. Because if we're talking about democracy, we need to understand that it's not about, like, let's pretend that it would be peace and nothing happened before. It's not about forgiveness. It's about justice. And justice, it's about punishment for the crime, not for ignorance and pretend blind that you do not see that someone killed a lot of other people.
There were court sentences against Russian soldiers who committed war crimes in Ukraine, but most of them were sentenced in absentia. So like the Russian soldiers were not present while the court was taking place against them. What's your opinion on these court sentences, you know, against Russian soldiers who have committed war crimes? Would you say that these sentences at least change something? There's a little bit of justice restored, or how would you, you know, consider them?
Yeah, I think it is at least something. It is a small drop that gives us beliefs that we do something like physically too, not only talking about this, but we already punished and have this court decision about these crimes. And this is also about motivation, because the huge scale escalation lasts 1,000 days. It's a horrible days of resilience when you don't know if you will have tomorrow. And for people that are still in Ukraine and they do their work and continue to do this work, it is very important to aware and to understand that something happened. It's maybe a small drop, but it's already a drop. And I hope we will have an ocean of changes in this area.
When you're thinking about your future plans, you know, not knowing whether there is an air attack within the next day, the next 2 days, within a week, what are your ideas for the future, how to do more than, you know, just documenting war crimes? Although documenting war crimes is already a huge amount of work and a very difficult work to do as a journalist. What are your ideas for the future?
You know, it's, thank you for those questions, because I allow myself to make a plans for the future. That's, for me, it means that I allow myself to have a future, because 2022 was for me like one big day without any numbers and names of the day. I just have a task, and we go for different points on the front line, and we do our stuff without nonstop. But now I understand that it's even in this situation when you don't know, you can't predict what will do Russian today or tomorrow, and where the Russian rocket would be shooted. And but I understand that now we have aim why we are living more clearly and more directly. And I think that documenting of war crime is one day stopped, and we will think about our rebuilding and restitution, and about even rehabilitation of our society, of our combatants, of their family, and to create a more stable and more strong society. And now I want to say that I'm very proud that I'm Ukrainian, because it's allowed me to talk about this everywhere and to proud, like sincerely proud that I am Ukrainian and I am resist 1,000 days of during huge scale escalation.
So the plans for the future are now concretely that you want to be more active in cybersecurity, as far as understood you correctly. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I think that the plans a little bit refocus. I don't think it's changed like particularly, but refocus, if you're talking about the resilience, so the cyber resilience, it is very important, and it's important for organization and for personal. Because if we're talking about the journalist in general, cyber resistance is about the ability to be more professional and to more sensitively talk about even war crimes, about the criminals, to protect themselves and to protect their sources, and to more professionally and more quickly identify the criminals. So it's like a complex story about this. And also, if you're talking about how the Russians combine cybersecurity attacks, IE technology, and disinformation, fakes, misinformation, propaganda. So they split all this together. And we have no choice. We need to orientate good in this issue, and we have to be protected. Because if small vulnerabilities make a big crimes and make a big attempts for Russian, and Ukraine now it's a big lab where the Russian tested everything, so we need to understand how it's happened and how to easily protect, because easily steps can protect you very good. For example, two-factor authentication. It sounds everyone know about this, but how many person have this on their gadget? This is the issue. So we need to be more protected and more resilient in this issue.
Well, you say that there is still a huge gap, or still a lot to know for Ukrainian journalists, or what is your experience, you know, like talking to Ukrainian journalists?
I think it's still a big gap, not only for Ukrainian journalists, it's like average attitudes. For example, I talked a lot with also international journalists, and they divided like, okay, in my professional fields, in my work computer, I didn't use, for example, Telegrams or Viber or non-licensed application. But for example, for my personal use, I can allow for myself to use this kind of stuff. And this is not about the cyber safety and security. It's about double standards that make treats and make challenges for and make a double risk for the professional activity of the journalist. And this is means that we need to form a culture, and we need to form an everyday practice and make a behavioral changes. This is not so easy and not so quick, but when we talk about the zero trust concept, it means that you evaluate like suspicious everything that you are working with, and you double check it. And of course, in situation with Ukrainian journalists, they are more vulnerable, because the situation, you are at the risk all the time, is a different kind of risk. Physical safety and security, emotional, and of course, cyber, it looks like, oh, come on, it's not hurt me, it's not killed me at the moment. But in general, it can cause a lot of problems for the media organization and for the journalist personally.
Can you describe briefly for people who are not into cybersecurity and are not working as journalists, what could be the risk? So why is it, especially for Ukrainian journalists, very important to know about cybersecurity and to take as many possible security measures they can?
Okay, first, it's that the journalist personally and the organization can lost their resources, like Facebook pages, different accounts in social media, in messengers, their site could be DOS, and they can lost some information. If, for example, it could be used combined technology, so the Russians could put on your site some fake information and share this information from your site, or can use spoofing, for example, copy your site it would be looks like your media site, but it would consist of fake information. Why is this a matter? It's issue about the trust. The Russians understand that the media and the journalists do their job pretty well, and the people trust them, and they like a testimony worldwide about what happened in Ukraine. So for them, it's very important to delay all this issue and to make hurt to the reputation of this media. The second is safety of the personally of the journalist and for their sources. For example, if the contact should be stolen from your telephone, from your messenger chat, it's a very simple thing. For example, you can check how many device is connected to your phone, to your Telegram channel, or to your WhatsApp channel. And nobody does this, but it is very effective, because if someone connected with some purpose and trying to hack your messenger, and it could be visible on your phone, then you know, just need to delay it. Also, the issue about phishing. This is the most maybe popular things in the cybersecurity field, when you receive some list that looks like official. It could be from the bank or from the, some governmental authorities or whatever, or with some, it can be look like newsletters with some information, and you can believe that it's real. And then it's okay if it's only disinformation, but it also can consist, they can stolen your personal data. For example, they can ask you to put your card numbers or your personal emails and parole of this mail. So it is very dangerous situation. So this is also, this could bring harm also to the media reduction, not only to the personal. And of course, if this phishing list sent to the audience and the from the media, and they give some personal information, and they understand that they have been treated by media, they do not check if it's really media do or it's a criminals do. So it's also about the reputation and to the and the trust, especially if it's do or on behalf of volunteers, organization who collect donations, like charity community, and this is also a very, very important issue.
You said in the beginning that your life is like divided into two parts, before the start of the full-scale invasion and after the start of the full-scale invasion. When you look back now and you think about how you dealt yourself before the full-scale invasion with cybersecurity, are you sometimes thinking, oh my God, I was so not aware of what I was doing? And how much I was not, you know, safe?
Oh, this is also a good question, because before the huge scale escalation, I conduct a lot of trainings for different groups in Kharkiv region. It's also was a governmental official, faculty staff, like schools and so on, so on, and also activists. And it was like a really big amount of trainings. And nobody evaluate it as a real threat, as a real risk or real dangers. Everyone know like a simple rules, and if you ask people, do you know the basic principle of safety and security, they said, of course, and give you an answer. Do you practice it? Oh, this is would be interesting answer. Not all. Or they do it like partly, or they use a double approach. For example, only for this computer because it's connected with work, but telephone, I can give my telephone to my grandchildren or to my children, and they playing and download some application that I'm safe. So this is the case. We are all living in a world that we do not expect like that risk become real. But now the war situation is changed particularly everything. Even according to my experience, I used to use Viber and Telegram. But when I started working in the front line, I delayed even application from my... It was hard in the first, but then I decided, okay, I don't have this application on my device, so I use another one. And everyone who want to communicate with me, they also use another one. So this is a very useful because people also change their practice because they understand that some bubble, some communities of people use only Signal or WhatsApp. So if you want to communicate with them, you need to download this application. So I think it's a common not only for Ukrainian, but Ukrainian feel this more strictly because it connected with the physical security. And this is that push people to make changes.
Are you having any concrete plans how long you would like to do more in the field of cybersecurity, or are you just now like really looking into it and are exploring for yourself?
I think the cybersecurity will be the main topics for maybe 10 years. It would be really important not only for Ukraine but globally, because it is effective. It is do not need like kinesthetic influence on any society. It could be very harmful, and it could be connected with, for example, AI and other technology, and make a lot of mess inside the democratic and other societies. So I think that this topic should be paying more attention, and it should be included in management of any organization. And we need to build like a real culture of cyber resilience and understand how to behave before, after, and during the cyber attacks.
When you talk to foreigners coming to Ukraine, do you have the impression that those people are behind, like the experience of Ukrainians, how important cybersecurity is? What is your personal experience, like having contact with people from abroad?
I think that they behave like average people, like average civilian people, except if I work with military journalists, they behave differently because it's like protocols of their professional ability and duty. But the other journalists, they do not see the connections between if they do something, for example, put some information or some documents in telegrams, what should happen. There are nothing like that can cause harm to national security of any country. But in the situation of war, any information could be used by the enemy, and we need to understand that even if we think that nothing interesting in this information, nothing interesting for the enemy, they can use it and they can use it against you. So this is very important to explain the international journalists that they should behave as the risk is as real as they can imagine.
And do you feel yourself a little bit paranoid sometimes when you explain to people not familiar with the context in Ukraine that they need to be aware of dangers basically everywhere?
Yeah, sometimes it looks like you are very suspicious and you try to avoid everything, and you're talking about everything. It's maybe looks strange. But what I used to do, I just make a cases and make an examples. And like, if you're talking about this scenario and talking not only, oh, command, not do this because, but you say, okay, we have a set of risk. Let's see what will happen if we continue to use, for example, such kind of messenger that we use. It is okay if you accept this risk and if you accept the circumstances and if you accept the scenario that you should do if this risk is happened, okay, you can use it, but I don't. So if you need to communicate with me, you need to use this one, this one, this one. And this is usually works because this is rationalize your behavior. You talk not emotionally and you do not look strange. And I conduct a lot of training about cybersecurity to the journalists. So it is absolutely practical without any emotions. And when you show the case, how it can be used and what kind of scenario Russian used, it's impressed. And people say, okay, we never think about this, that this is simple things can be used like this. So this is the issue.
Can you use one example here as well? where cybersecurity, a basic rule, was not respected and it actually was misused by the Russian army for their purposes?
The first, maybe it's about the messengers, the unsafe messengers that also Ukrainian military used to use. It was like Vibers and so on. And the case that they can use it to even hack, for example, the Signal or WhatsApp messenger or to track the information in this messenger. This means that even if you use for, it's about this double standards approach. For example, you can use Signal for working communication, but have Viber for a chat with your grandma on the same telephone, on the same device. And this is also unsafe. And this is maybe the most common issue for today, because I think that almost everyone know about the unsafe issue and how it could be used, and a lot of talking about this, and even the most wave of disinformation share via this messenger. But this double approach, okay, I don't do something wrong, I'm just talking with my grandpa. But this is the risk. If you use your messenger to talk with your grandma, the grandma may be used by criminals as the easiest way to hack all your other messengers.
How do you work as a journalist, you know, when you're limited, you know, when you try to reach out to people? It's not just one thing that people would like to reach you, but when you are trying to contact someone and these people are only using these kind of not safe channels, how you get in contact with them as a journalist? What are your workarounds?
In this case, I recommend to have a separate device that have only this messenger, do not have your personal account like Google accounts, mails and other main messengers. So one phone, other number of phones and only one messenger. But this is also unsafe because it could be tracked. For example, we know that Viber can share your geolocation even if everything is switched off. So it is better to use only phone and to physically phone. We forgot about this option on the telephone that we can talk using the mobile connection, not only messenger that we have. But yes, this is a difficulty, especially if you work in a frontline territories or in liberated territory. It is better to not use this messenger at all.
Do you yourself catch yourself by reading or, you know, educate yourself on the topic, and you catch yourself with the moment that you read about something you never thought of, that it could be dangerous? Is it like for you the same, that you learn every day something new about it, or how is that for you going?
No, it's sometimes I catch myself that, oh my God, I need to change the settings. I need to change them a long period of time, but I didn't do it. I need to do this. So it's like this. You need to aware and understand that all these attempts to hack an average person, they are very simple. They're not complicated. They cheap and simple. So they do not invent some big technology. They do not need to have access to. They use a very simple things. If you are not protected, they hack you, and they'll see if the information that you have, it is useful. And you need to aware that if, for example, Russians want to hack you or your organization, you have no choice. They do this. They can invest in this money, resources, and nothing can protect you for 100%. But the resilience and the awareness of cybersecurity protocols and rules give you ability to work and to recover after this, and to continue to work professionally in the field. This is the difference. This is makes sense. Because if you are targeted, you have been hacked. But you... The questions, if you have your hub archive, or if you have still have access to your websites or Facebook pages or your accounts, it's an issue about your protocols or what you have been done before or you haven't done.
Have yourself you wondered whether you have been hacked in the past and you might never?
Yes, I have such kind of experience. Yes. I would not to talk maybe in detail yet, but I have this despair and I feel it in my own. And I've not been protected properly at this period of time. This happened at the start of 2022. And yes, it is harmful and it is, I'm still feel the what happened, how it can cause to my even professional activity.
We're now today, when we're recording this podcast episode, like the full-scale invasion is already going on for 1,000 days. Looking back on these 1,000 days of the full-scale invasion, does it feel for you like 1,000 days, or is it for you personally more like 1,000 years?
It's again a very hard questions because for me it feels like a different life. Like a long, different life, and I feel like a different person. That at once lost everything and start to live again and start to find again senses of your living and to rebuild everything, to build your reality from small pieces. But these pieces are different. They are not that you had before, because they totally destroyed by Russian weapon, like physically. My house is destroyed, and this area it's a front line now, and it's very strange feeling, because you understand that you are strong, and you are strong inside enough to resist and to build something. And it's very hard to do a simple things like allow yourself to live, allow yourself to be happy, allow yourself to make like every day small happy things like breakfast with the family, because it's so unique and it's so harmful and it's so unstable in this reality. That you even afraid to breathe because you think that it could be disappeared in one moment because of some air alarms and air attacks and so on. So. And this is a particular different life during, I can say that it's all days would be the same because I have a part when I work in the front line and it's particular different life and particular different person that have a horrible experience, but very vulnerable for me experience, and it's really changed a lot of situation in my life now. But yeah, it's look well, something like this.
Olga Kusha, thank you so much for being guest on my podcast today, and I'm 100% sure that you can be proud of yourself of what you've achieved during the last 1,000 days and what you're still going to achieve. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.